This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 36th in a series of interviews with security gurus. For this episode, we'll do something different. James McGovern is an enterprise architect at The Hartford. He's going to interview me for Silver Bullet's third anniversary extravaganza. Hi, James.
Hello.
Tell me about your victim today, please.
Gary McGraw is CTO of Cigital and a prolific author. Gary holds a PhD in computer science and cognitive science from Indiana University, where his advisor was Doug Hofstadler. He also has a BA in philosophy from the University of Virginia. Gary's professional focus is software security. He has written 10 books, including Building Secure Software, Exploiting Software, and Software Security. And he is the editor of Addison Wesley's Software Security series. Gary also writes a monthly column for Informant, produces two podcasts, this one and Reality Check, and does what he can to cut through the software security nonsense. Gary lives with his wife, Amy Barley, his sons, Jack and Eli, four dogs, several cats, a horse, a pony, a peacock, and 19 chickens on a Shenandoah River in Virginia. His band, Where Aubrey, performs annual fundraisers for the Blue Ridge Area Food Bank, one of which happens tomorrow. Let me start with my first question. Gary, Cigital and Fortify have partnered to release the Building Security and Maturity Model, where you outline practices and approaches of enterprises that actually have a clue in making their security posture better. Could you describe some of the human aspects of the leaders of these organizations, such as their backgrounds, business verticals, their personalities, those types of characteristics?
Yeah, that's a great question. I sure could. One of the interesting things about this work was it struck us to study real software security initiatives that are underway and have been for a while. And as you might imagine, many of the people running some of these initiatives are friends of mine just because we all work in the same discipline. So out of the 35 programs that we're aware of, we picked what we consider to be the top nine. And I just called up the people that are running them and said, hey, you guys want to do some science? And we all laughed about it being kind of like anthropology. And everyone agreed. The backgrounds of these guys vary pretty widely. You know, Steve Lipner has been doing computer security for almost as long as I've been alive. And he worked in the early days on firewalls and network security stuff, helped to stand up Microsoft's Vulnerability Response Center, and then moved into software security from there, and has just been instrumental in getting the Trustworthy Computing Initiative at Microsoft to be useful. On the other hand, Brad Arkin, who is running the program at Adobe, was one of my guys. In 1997, he helped to form the software security group with me at Cigital. And so I have a really different relationship with both of those guys. But they're both very committed professionals and really interested in causing software security to occur. Then one other story, on the human side, Jim Routh, who you might know from the Depository Trust and Clearing Corporation, is sort of a quintessential New York executive. He's very savvy politically, understands how to position software security as a money thing, and is very good at publicity, and not only that, runs one hell of a software security program. So these guys all have fairly diverse backgrounds among the nine, and the cool thing is they're all willing to talk about what they're doing. I guess that was the most exciting part of this project. We weren't sure what we were getting into when everybody agreed to do the interviews, and everyone was so forthcoming that building the model was exciting because we had all this real data to work on.
Okay. The guys, the three people that you just mentioned, it sounds like they're all from a technical background at some level. Are there IT executives out there that understand software security that are just business people?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I really don't know any.
Okay.
But I will say this about these people. They're the sort of hybrid people that can speak business and also have a very deep technical background. And as you know, those kind of creatures are rare on Earth. Right now, it appears that they might be necessary to cause software security initiatives to be a success. Hopefully, we'll gain enough experience and write down enough empirical science. That won't be the case in the future.
Okay. As we all know, working in a large enterprise, sometimes working on security agendas is somewhat of a thankless job, in that there's always a desire for people to go out and consult because there's, you know, it's a little bit more lucrative. What are these guys doing to keep top talent on staff such that they can sustain their software security programs?
Well, I think one of the things about software security that's naturally appealing is it's an intellectual challenge, and it's an awful lot of fun. So it's not a domain that is stagnating or is boring or you end up doing the same thing every day all day. Instead, trying to figure out how to teach, say, tens of thousands of developers in some situations, or maybe hundreds in smaller initiatives, is something that's really fun. And it takes a combination of skills. You have to have the right kind of technical skills to be able to pull off, say, a code review in various different languages, and capabilities to talk to, understand, and work with enterprise architects, which, as you know, can be a real challenge.
Definitely.
And the capability of moving up the food chain and justifying what you do. So I think that kind of the natural coolness factor of software security may be one of the things that these guys use to help them retain their top talent. Okay. As you know, I'm a consultant, and I have the same issue, frankly. Over the years, I've mentored and trained a whole slew of people, many of whom ran out and started their own companies, which was fine with me because it's kind of like, you know, seeding the world with this software security idea. And frankly, if you understand that the world is a small place and that people are going to have their own career path and they're going to follow their own way, and you understand that that's good and you work with that, it can actually turn out to be a benefit in the long run.
Since you mentioned enterprise architects and being one by trade, I have to ask the question, do you think that enterprise architects are blissfully ignorant when it comes to understanding software security, and what do you think is going to kind of change that?
Well, certainly not all of them, James.
Thank you.
We have an existence proof. I think that a lot of enterprise architects kind of end up in what you might call the UML cloud of utter nonsense. Not all of them, but you know, when I go to somebody and an architect of any sort and ask them what does your system do, and they pull out the big binder with the 6,000 page UML stuff, I know that I'm in trouble.
Okay.
And that those guys probably don't understand security. On the other hand, there are enterprise architects who are very much hands-on and roll up their sleeves and get involved in building frameworks and figuring out how to use struts properly, teaching people how to use the technology that's constantly changing, and also think about security at the same time. And that's a very powerful position because you can build security functionality, and at the same time you can think about security as trying to avoid vulnerabilities and trying to do correct design all at the same time. So, you know, coming up with, say, a framework that has examples of security patterns in it and then propagating that throughout an entire enterprise is an incredibly valuable activity that we noticed in the BSIM. And unfortunately, I think it's all too rare. So the more people doing that, the better off we're all going to be.
As you are aware, many enterprises are now outsourcing or offshoring software development. So what are the challenges there in terms of having a software security practice, especially when it kind of applies to third parties?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the challenges is that many of the people who decided to offshore to India couldn't even outsource to downstairs before they got started. So they just added a 2,000-mile problem to their inability to, say, set clear requirements and set acceptance criteria. Those two factors are very helpful, but really I think outsourcing, and looking at outsourcing in particular, as its own thing is almost xenophobic. And the real problem is other people's code. You know, if you consume COTS or you buy software from vendors or you cause other people to write software for you, you have the same problem. How do I know I can trust it? What sorts of testing should I do before I accept it, the thing? How should I bind it from a legal perspective? We touch on some of these activities in the BSIM, and there are some leaders in the space. Jim Routh, who I mentioned before, is a guy who I would certainly turn to talk to about how he is controlling his vendors, because I think he's kind of a bellwether for things to come.
Okay. I've heard the analogy before that you literally have to kind of specify anything and everything to make outsourcing even remotely successful. Do you think that secure software development, when it occurs in India, China, wherever you may be happen to outsource, will ever become just something that's part of the product versus something that's considered a special service?
That's a great question. I don't know, but I do, in my work, I travel around the planet and, you know, do a lot of advocacy. I used to call it evangelism till last week, and then I decided that was too Christian of a word, and advocacy is a better word. So I'm a software security advocate, and I go out and see what's going on in, say, Europe or the West Coast versus, say, New York or your area. And things are in a different state. I'd say that the West Coast is maybe 6 months to a year behind. They're still stuck in penetration testing thinking. Okay. And Europe appears to be about 2 years behind, where they're even, you know, they need help understanding that software security is a problem at all. They haven't even started doing regular pen testing in a lot of places in Europe. Now, this doesn't apply to everywhere, of course. This is just a big generality. On the India front, there are a few outsourcing collectives who have been constrained in terms of what they're supposed to deliver from a security perspective. And I know we've actually done some training over there, and Sigital has a fully owned subsidiary over there. And that's an interesting thing. It allows us to teach some people that are delivering in India how to do the right thing. But it feels like it's going to be a while before that's part of the normal approach to doing business. Regarding Asia-Pac, I haven't been there personally, so all of my data is secondhand, and so I can't really say anything.
Okay. Do you think that industry analyst firms such as Gartner and Forrester are doing enough to write and provide thoughtful coverage on software security?
I would point people at your blog entry, which we'll do on the website. But here's the deal with analysts. Analysts like to cover a space that's worth a lot of money. And the magic number appears to be about $500 million. I have tracked the software security space's growth over the last several years, and collected revenue numbers from all the players, including the source code review guys, the black box testing guys, the consulting people, including my firm, and watched the space grow over the years. Guess what number we just crossed in 2008? 500 million. And guess what? We saw the first Gartner Magic Quadrant for the space appear. Now, it only covers source code analysis tools like Fortify and Ounce and Clockwork and Coverity and that kind of tool, which is kind of a bummer because I think that the analysts there, Joe Feynman and Neil McDonald, actually understand that software security is way more than tools. But, you know, analysts make their money by telling the middle market what they should buy, something that people that are ahead of the market, like say you, already have determined for themselves. So you got to remember that analysts don't really exist for the Jameses of the world. They exist for, you know, Fifth Third Bank in Iowa, or other people who may not be right at the cutting edge, but who are coming to realize that they have to do something for software security. I think it's kind of an interesting game. You know, I've been accused of being an analyst by the press more than once, and that always makes me take pause and wonder whether I'm doing enough science. Okay. Hopefully some of the BSIM activity will answer that. That's been the most exciting thing I've done in the last 5 years. And I think it's fun to try to participate and actually lead the transformation of software security from alchemy to science.
Okay, that's fair. Since you mentioned static analysis, as you're probably aware, many organizations no longer budget for developer tools. We get tools like Eclipse and those types of things for free.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that static analysis will kind of fail because no one's kind of funding developer tools?
Well, so far, there's been no evidence of that from the market. You know, tracking the software security space, I can tell you that the 2008 numbers show about a 40% growth in source code analysis tools and about a 30 or 32% growth in black box testing tools, which are mostly around the web, as you know. That means that that this intuition that there's no budget must not apply to everybody because somebody's paying for these tools. And, you know, we're talking about a market in the source code analysis space that easily accounted for maybe 200 million of the 500 million in the software security space. So I think that it's continuing to grow. Now, you did mention Eclipse, and that's worth pursuing a little bit. You know, they give away IDEs for free, and it's very clear to me and to John Steven and others that many of the techniques and scanning attempts that these source code analysis tools do could in fact be encapsulated by the IDE. I mean, it should notice when you're typing a stupid function and tell you why not to do that. What it won't be able to do is multi-pass compilation data flow analysis type stuff, which these tools are beginning to do a little bit better. But I think some of the really easy stuff is going to be just taken over by the IDE. We will know that source code analysis has arrived as soon as the big players get serious about it. And by big players, I mean IBM and HP.
Okay. So many of the static analysis tools right now are primarily targeted towards the enterprise marketplace. What tools would you recommend for people that have, you know, software development concerns that are, say, two or three developers and really can't afford the enterprise dollars attached to the other tools?
You know, that's a great question. I don't have a good answer for that. We started out this space in 1999 releasing an open source tool. Actually, we called it open-ish source, called ITS4, which stood for It's the Software Stupid Security Scanner. And then Viega quit Sigital and produced another tool called RATS, which was basically a clone of ITS4. These were really simple tools that used grep-like approaches, just a simple list. And they had, as a result, lots of false positives. Those tools are still available for use by small projects, and they're worth every penny you pay for them, I'll tell you that. But in terms of real power, there really is no equivalent in the open source space or in the I can't afford $50,000 space for these static analysis tools right now. Perhaps some service providers will get into the mix and provide code review services that make use of these tools. You know, perhaps the Veracode pipe dream will come true and, you know, you'll be able to just look at a list of things that have already been scanned. But I don't think we really know what the answer is for small and mid-sized players yet.
Okay. Well, one of the thoughts that I had for small and mid-sized players is actually focused around kind of educational opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And there are groups such as OWASP where you can learn about software security kind of free of charge by attending local user groups. What do
Yep.
you think other groups should be doing to help educate people on software security other than what OWASP is already doing?
Well, I know there's some groups that are in it for the money, like SANS, that are trying to educate, you know, mostly security people about software security. But I like this notion of collectives that are trying to gather knowledge for themselves, the OWASP being, you know, the most important one by far. I like what OWASP is doing from its heart. I worry about the actual content of some of the OWASP stuff because the early days emphasized web application security way too much. And you probably know from discussions with me over the years that I think the software security problem is a much larger problem than just a bunch of problems with web apps.
Agreed.
So, you know, that was always my big concern about OWASP. And as long as it doesn't degenerate into a club of consultants that are all trawling for work hilariously from each other, OWASP can be quite powerful. We've tried to involve ourselves in OWASP Europe a lot, and John Stephen was recently elected the head of the OWASP chapter down here in Virginia, in NOVA. So, you know, we'll continue to publish our work as widely as possible and use OWASP as one of the distribution channels. I do want to say this. It's possible to create IP and release it under things like the Creative Commons, even if you're not affiliated with a group like OWASP, and the BSIM is one of those efforts. So, you know, we're trying to create a yardstick for software security, and we're trying to put it out in such a way that everybody can use it without worrying about who owns it.
Okay. No podcast would probably be complete without at least allowing you the opportunity to attack Microsoft.
So I already said a good thing about them.
So we have to acknowledge that they're kind of the industry's whipping boy when it comes to software security.
Right.
But one of the questions that I have is kind of what I'll call the schizophrenic enterprise behavior. So on one hand, enterprises kind of like backward compatibility. On another hand, sometimes security requires you to change APIs and interfaces.
Yep.
So what would you tell CIOs and other IT executives that kind of want to sit on both sides of the table and complain?
Well, that's a toughie. I mean, the answer is if you straddle too wide a gap and the gap is growing, you're going to fall in it.
Yep.
So with regard to particular platforms, I think we know we all have issues with single points of failure and, you know, relying too heavily on one thing, which is what happened to the Native Americans when, you know, smallpox was our way of what we called manifest destiny through biological warfare back in those days. And we have to watch out for that same effect in IT. So I think that the paper that Dan Gere wrote long ago about the monoculture problem is still worth thinking carefully about if you were a CIO and you had to run a large enterprise. But when it comes to Microsoft, I think that they've taken, you know, their problematic operating system from way, way back to heart and tried very hard to come up with something better. The answer of how you do that risk management trade-off is always a really tricky challenge. And I wouldn't want to be in their shoes trying to figure out how much security is enough for most people
okay.
or for however umpity-ump jillions of people use Windows, because that's a really hard thing to try to figure out. I also worry a little bit about Vista, because Vista, even though it went through the SDL and seems to be more secure on the surface of it, has been pilloried for being too secure because of some of the DRM features in it. And I hope that that doesn't become so strongly associated with software security that the whole field suffers because of the particular trade-offs that, say, Vista made.
Okay. If Microsoft were to kind of conquer and master software security, and they could kind of essentially start throwing some other enterprise vendor under the bus, who do you think they would target?
I think there's already been some evidence of that. Remember when David Litchfield used to always out Microsoft and he would hit him with an O-Day and really just poke him in the eye? Well, they got him under contract and they aimed him right at Marianne Davidson at Oracle.
Okay.
And I thought that was a pretty clever move. I don't know if they did it on purpose, but the result was that, you know, Oracle was getting thrown under the bus by David.
Okay. Many CIOs and business executives alike like the concept of metrics. What metrics should people be thinking about related to software security?
Now, that's a great question. We have an unfortunate result to describe to the world coming out of the BSIM study. And that is that everybody agrees that metrics are important. And not only that, all of the nine that we studied use metrics. And they all have their own metrics that are great. And they think the metrics are a key part of their program. The problem is that all of the metrics are directly tied to the culture of the organization that's using them. And so it's very hard to take an idea for measurement from one organization and transplant it to another. I kind of liken it to organ transplant.
Okay.
You know, chances of rejection by the host are high. And so that means it's more of a challenge than, say, people that participate in the security metrics list, or even, say, Andrew Jaquith himself might think in the beginning. So what we've come to in the BSIM is, hey, let's just look at activities and let's do some measurement of activities and not try to measure the resulting software to see whether or not it's secure. Now, that's a problem with our science, because we can say these organizations that appear to be building better software are doing the following activities, but we can't say for certain, and that is, in fact, resulting in more secure software in any objective fashion, because there just simply aren't any metrics. And the silly metrics that, you know, we all talk about, like, say, defect density per KLOC and stuff like that, are not very useful at measuring actual software security, as you know. They're just sort of kind of like indicators. It'd be like figuring out how your car's doing by looking only at the temperature gauge. And so we have that challenge to face. We think that the notion of publishing a BSIM yardstick and having people apply that all over the place is going to be very helpful from a metrics perspective, and we hold out great hope that that'll actually happen.
Okay. So as you're probably aware, based on today's current economic climate, budgets are kind of under pressure. So if you had to focus on software security with all things being important, how would you determine what's more important between, say, buying a static analysis tool, doing log management, federated identity, entitlements management? How would you guide a IT executive to make that trade-off?
Well, I think that the answer is always going to be dependent on the organization. I hate to be slippery, and I don't mean to be slippery, but I think that's the real answer. So, for example, among the nine, one of the cultures that we studied is very much code-driven. It's a codocentric culture. It's a bunch of, you know, Unix hackers that are C kernel guys and amazingly great coders. If you want to approach software security with them, it had better be about the code. On the other hand, there are organizations that have regulatory compliance issues, and they need to think about other aspects of software security, and so a codocentric approach might not work as well in their culture. And so really the answer is you have to look at the situation and figure out what is going to benefit you the most. You know, that's why consultants like us get paid money to do that sort of thing, because it turns out that there isn't really kind of an obvious answer for everyone.
Okay. So speaking of kind of regulations, many enterprises are focused on PCI right now,
mm-hmm.
you know. So I think there's kind of two questions I would like to ask around that. First, do you think that PCI is kind of doing enough from a prescriptive perspective? And then secondly, do you think that enterprises are being asked too much to spend too much money on this particular problem?
My own opinion from a technical perspective is that PCI is utterly useless. So it's caused people to think about software security. That's a good side effect. That's the same good side effect, incidentally, as, say, the SAN CWE Top 25 list, which is also in the same bucket, in my opinion.
Okay.
The issue is, if people think about software security, that's good. But if they believe that they can attain software security by buying a web application firewall, they're crazy. And frankly, I hope that companies that I use that collect my credit card data do a better job and try to actually protect my own personal data using real software security techniques and not just checking the PCI box by buying a WAF or causing one code review to happen. So, you know, I'm not in the rah-rah PCI camp. I'm in the, yeah, that was pretty lame, why don't we try to do better camp. Okay.
Well, how would you suggest making it more security more visible to consumers?
Well, that's a good question. I think consumers already have an intuition that's incorrect, that all the stuff they buy is secure. They sort of have this inherent expectation, is a better way of putting it. And the problem is it isn't. So the first thing you have to do is tell them, hey, that stuff you thought was secure isn't. And then they're going to be mad. And after they're done being mad, then maybe you can start working on it. So it's kind of a marketer's nightmare is the real answer, because people think for no apparent reason that their cell phone is not a walkie-talkie, for example. And it is a walkie-talkie.
Yeah. So in terms of software vendors, we're familiar with the initiatives that Michael Howard of Microsoft is doing and Marianne Davidson of Oracle. What do you think the smaller software vendors are doing? And do you have any good examples of small, you know, 10-person software vendors doing something meaningful in this space?
I don't have enough examples of that. And that's one of the criticisms that can be correctly leveled at the BSIM study, which is obviously aimed at larger organizations.
Okay.
There is one thing we can draw from the study, though, which is that there are some activities that everybody does. And by looking at those 10 out of the 110 activities, it seems pretty clear that even small companies that are two-person shops could adopt some of those activities. And so that might be the way for them to get started, but I don't know the real answer.
To become a competent software security professional, what do you think the ideal career path looks like? So, for example, give us the three lines that we need to tell our enterprise HR departments.
Okay. Must be a coder. That's the only line, really. And then we can teach them everything else. So I think the notion of starting with people that are very steeped in software development is the only way to go. And, you know, there's some people like me that have been coding since they were 15 and maybe don't code every day now, but we're software guys. And those people, in my experience, make the best software security people if they also have kind of a twisted evil mind and can think like a bad guy. Okay. So you need to look for that, too. But if I had to choose one over the other, I would certainly choose software smarts over malicious mental capabilities.
So how do you think that the enterprise could support thinking like an attacker, right? When you're in a culture of perception management, where your ID is PowerPoint, those types of things.
Yeah, good question. I don't know. I'm not a big company guy.
Fair enough.
My dad was. I thought he was crazy.
Thank you for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks, James. This has been really fun. This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The March-April issue of IEEE Security and Privacy will investigate the ongoing debate about the effectiveness of computer forensics, static versus dynamic analysis, and the legal implications of a field evolving at light speed. Subscribe today at www.computer.org/security/BSI-sub. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.